Alors, sans plus attendre, j'ai le grand plaisir d'accueillir à présent le professeur Hans-Johann Glock, professeur ordinaire de philosophie à l'Université de Zurich, responsable de PRN Evolving Language, membre de l'Institute for the Study of Language Evolution. Après des études de philosophie, de linguistique et de mathématiques à Tübingen, à Berlin, un doctorat à Oxford, Hans-Johann Glock a été Junior Research Fellow à St. John's College, Oxford, puis professeur de philosophie à l'Université de Reading. Il a reçu le prix de recherche 2014-2015 de la Fondation Alexander von Humboldt. Ses recherches s'articulent dans les domaines de la philosophie de l'esprit, la philosophie du langage, l'histoire de la philosophie analytique et l'anthropologie philosophique. Parmi ses ouvrages, on compte notamment Wittgenstein Dictionary, 1996, Quine et Davidson, 2003, What is Analytic Philosophy, 2008, traduit en français par Frédéric Neff chez Gallimard, La mente de los animales, 2009, et Normativity, Meaning and Philosophy, Essays on Wittgenstein, en cours de publication. Voilà.
Merci.
Eh bien, un grand merci, et je pense que, justement, nous allons en savoir un petit peu plus sur l'une des questions que j'ai abordées, qui concerne précisément l'ingénierie conceptuelle. Donc, cher Hans-Johann, à vous. Metaphysics, conceptual engineering and conceptual analysis, historical and conceptual associations. Bienvenue à vous.
Merci beaucoup, Claudine. Je suis, il faut que je demande pardon pour ne faire pas ce discours en français. Ça serait trop difficile pour moi. Et aussi, il faut que un grand merci pour l'invitation, parce que je suis plus d'un anti-métaphysicien qu'un métaphysicien, pour être honnête. All right, but without much further ado, let me just switch to English, and you know, I'm going to talk about three enterprises, two venerable, one allegedly a complete and utter revolution, but I will dispute that. I hope that I will, you know, touch on some of those connections between metaphysics, what is questions, and epistemology in the course of this presentation. Okay. I'm not. How do I advance? This one. Oh, okay, sorry, yeah. I've got two mottos here. One from Otto, a motto from Otto. I think it should be pretty self-explanatory at the end why I insist on the much quoted and little understood metaphor of Neurath's boat. The other one is just an indication that I am a pretty unapologetic conceptual analyst. Okay. I'll first introduce you to my aim, then I'll talk about connections between metaphysics and conceptual engineering, then about the connections between conceptual engineering and conceptual analysis. I'll then address a common complaint about conceptual analysis, namely it's only concerned with words. Echt philosophers should be concerned with things. Now, against the claims of radical conceptual engineers like Kaplan, I shall insist that conceptual engineering presupposes conceptual analysis. I will then revisit the question of whether conceptual analysts aren't concerned with reality because concepts are part of reality. I'll deny this because I think that the concern of conceptual analysts with concepts is a very special one. It's a dialectic one, I should say. And finally, if there's time, I shall look at the connection between what is questions, intuitions, and participatory knowledge. You know, so essences, my understanding of essences is very limited. It's confined to understanding what is questions. And so I will, look at what is questions, and I will maintain that conceptual analysis, contrary to a widespread prejudice, does not appeal to or rely on intuitions, but that it explicates a kind of participatory knowledge. It explicates our linguistic competence. Okay. So, you know, I have been provoked for 2 or 3 years now by conceptual engineering. You know, they've made so much noise and so successfully that, you know, envy, you know, is a just punishment, and I will mete it out today. So now, conceptual engineering is often presented as a radically novel metaphilosophical stance. It is claimed that it supersedes or at least provides the foundations for all other philosophical projects. And it's also claimed that it displays the utter futility of conceptual analysis. Now, I'll take issue with these three claims by conceptual engineers. And I'll do so by looking at some historical and conceptual connections between these three enterprises. I shall also defend conceptual analysis against both conceptual engineering and revisionary metaphysics. So there's a very strong anti-revisionary streak to my presentation. And I'll try to indicate what kind of knowledge conceptual analysis provides and how that knowledge is connected to what is questions. Okay, now, is conceptual engineering the revolution in philosophy as which it has been presented? No, conceptual engineering is just one type of what used to be known as concept formation, a label which I commend to you favorably. Why the older label has the advantage of including introductions and modifications of concepts for the sake of capturing extant phenomena, whereas conceptual engineering, you know, at least projects itself as fiddling with concepts or introducing new concepts simply for suiting, one's own purposes. Now, concept formation of the capturing extant feature kind has been central both to traditional metaphysics and science. There's absolutely nothing novel about it. But I won't dwell on that. It's pretty clear that conceptual engineering arises out of conceptual analysis. And I think moderate versions of it are close to liberal versions of conceptual analysis of the kind that I, among others, have propounded. Okay, next point. Concerning B, does conceptual engineering provide the foundations of philosophy? Again, a resolute no, for two reasons. Claims to the effect that one philosophical method or discipline is more fundamental than all the others are suspect, both in principle and for historical reasons. The history of philosophy is littered with claims like that, and they've all failed. Metaphysics isn't foundational. Even logic may not be foundational, and that's by far the best bet. Okay, so concerning B and C, I think concept formation requires conceptual analysis because for the simple reason, improving a conceptual scheme presupposes at least a minimal understanding of it. Concerning C, criticisms leveled by both engineers and metaphysicians that conceptual analysis makes do with mere words are misguided. Here, a claim which I don't really think I can deliver, but I think just to provoke you, what is questions are best answered either by science or by conceptual analysis, depending on what kind of what is question this is. Finally, and that's perhaps more productive and constructive, conceptual analysis does not rely on intuitions, but explicates what I, following Hare and Hanfling, call participatory knowledge. Okay, so metaphysics. I'm really hesitant to present this here in a culture which is so rich in historical learning, but this is a kind of Galtonian image of Aristotle and Wolf and Quine. Okay, so metaphysics, you know, seeks knowledge of the most general and fundamental features of reality, A. B, it does so without appeal to experience, and C, the insights are supposed to go beyond the insights gained by science. Now, Metaphysica Generalis, in my book, asks the question, what is existence? I won't say much about that. Metaphysica Specialis pursues the question that Quine called the ontological question, namely, what kinds or categories of things exist? And that question raises the question of natures or essences. What are the essential features that distinguish these fundamental kinds? And this is where my what is questions come in. The question of essences is in turn related to the what is F, or what is an F, what is justice, what is a case of free will. And these are the questions that, you know, don't exhaust conceptual analysis, but they're certainly not unimportant. Okay, so now, how does metaphysics stand to conceptual engineering? Well, I think they're both potentially or more or less strongly revisionist. So traditional pre-Kantian metaphysics shares the revisionary impetus of conceptual engineering. Why? Our established ways of thinking and talking are always potentially subject to criticism and change, for they should mirror the nature of reality rather than mirroring mere appearances or our prejudices. But it is this mind-to-world direction of fit which contrasts with much of contemporary conceptual engineering. The label indicates, after all, an analogy not with physics, which captures, you know, what the world is like, but with engineering. You know, you create something to suit your own ends. So it conceptual engineering presents itself not as paying heed to what's already there, but as constructing ideas for the sake of satisfying your, for instance, practical purposes or for expressing your attitudes. I incidentally, in spite of the fact that I think the place in front of this building is named after Michel Foucault, I'm strongly anti-Nietzschean. So, you know, I'm with traditional metaphysics on this one. I have less sympathy for the sort of more Nietzschean fiddling with concepts. Okay, so conceptual engineering and conceptual analysis. Conceptual engineers can adopt three different attitudes towards conceptual analysis. They can simply understand it as a modification and extension. They can repudiate conceptual analysis, and they can be indifferent to it. Now, I'll just look at the second option. My claim, the repudiation of conceptual analysis by what I call exclusionary conceptual engineering, is untenable for a very simple-minded reason. Conceptual engineering and conceptual ethics, as it's also sometimes called, presuppose conceptual self-understanding. Okay, now my main target here will be Hermann Kaplan, because I think he gives very vivid and striking expression to a sentiment which pervades much, not all, but much of conceptual engineering. So for Kaplan, conceptual engineering is the activity of assessing and developing improvements of our representational devices. He presents this project as radically opposed to conceptual analysis, but this runs up against what I call a descriptivist truism. Improving conceptual schemes in a way that is epistemically controlled and practically fruitful simply presupposes an understanding of the conceptual status quo. Right? Improving, for instance, electric cars, presupposes an understanding of what they are like right now. So, I mean, that's perhaps not the best example, but you know, you can see where I'm going. So, I think the condemnation of conceptual analysis by conceptual engineering constitutes a real paradox. And I think this paradox has been taken far more seriously than it is up to this point. Yeah? How can you prove something, you know, in a controlled, epistemically controlled way without having some understanding of what you're improving? Okay. Words, concepts, and things. Now, here is a complaint you hear about conceptual analysis from basically all quarters, namely, it needs to be superseded because one should be concerned with things rather than words or concepts, and, you know, as philosophers. Now, you know, in conceptual engineering, that sentiment, you know, is expressed in a particularly striking fashion. So, according to conceptual engineers, we should not ask, what is the concept of F? You know, what is the concept of justice? How does it compare to the concept of distributive justice, etc.? But, and we shouldn't ask, what does F mean? What does knowledge mean? But rather, what concept of, let's say, knowledge should we have, or what should knowledge mean? And here is Kaplan. Conceptual engineering operates directly on extensions and intentions, i.e. things in the world. It is about knowledge, freedom, what is right, women, marriage, and salad. It is not about the words, and it's not about concepts. I don't appeal to any. When doing conceptual engineering, we are deciding how these things should be. We are deciding how knowledge, freedom, what is right, women, marriage, and salad should be. I think that really should, you know, that requires some sampling, this statement. Now, you know, that's very strange. How should what, you know, Hermann does, you know, in his concept lab, change what salad is? Kaplan concedes that there is an obvious element of truth in the idea that conceptual engineering concerns words and their meanings. The change that it aims at is not a matter of the world changing. You know, this is a case of Austin's diagnosis. There's the bit where they say it, and there's the bit where they take it back. So it's not a case of the world changing, but of changes in extensions that are driven by changes in intention. So by any other names, we are changing, you know, the extension of an expression by changing its meaning. What Hermann singularly fails to do is distinguish between two senses of operating on. You guys have a handout, is that correct? Yes. You know, we must distinguish operating on extensions. Extensions are sets and hence abstract, and objects within the extension, elements of sets that can be concrete. Now, you know, short of linguistic idealism, conceptual engineering can alter what the extension of an expression is by altering its intention. It cannot change the objects within that extension, right? By redefining the concept, you can change what falls under in the extension, but you can't change any object in that extension. So, you know, what is the moral of this for improving things? Now, I think both conceptual analysts and conceptual engineers can improve things, but not by changing things, but they can change how we think or talk about things. So an example, my wife is a parental counselor. You know, she, unlike Hermann, can change the extension of the two-place predicate or two-place property parental neglect. Right? She can change that extension by operating on improving the parental relationship between Jim and his daughter, Sarah. Right? That's a very straightforward case of improving things. Changing the extension of parental neglect through altering its intention cannot affect the world in this direct way. So, you know, Hermann is simply wrong in thinking that you can, you know, change things directly through conceptual engineering. You can know, you know, I think conceptual analysis and conceptual engineering are on the same level here. They cannot operate on individuals that are F, but they can equally be about the world in one sense, both clarifying and changing the concept F concerns what an F is, what it is to parentally neglect, what constitutes parental neglect, or what counts as parental neglect. And therefore, both conceptual analysis and conceptual engineering can improve things, i.e., how things are, indirectly by elucidating or modifying how we think, speak, and argue about them. The idea that conceptual engineering has a sort of direct access to the world, that, you know, it has more of an impact on women, freedom, or salad, then conceptual analysis is just simply bosh, okay? All right, so now, I think here I'll just say, you know, there is a legitimate challenge, I think, that Kaplan poses, namely, you know, if you engage in conceptual engineering, you owe us an account of what concepts are. Because, you know, otherwise your views on engineering are hard to assess. You don't really have an account of conceptual engineering unless you have an account of concepts. I think, you know, this challenge applies equally to conceptual analysis. But that challenge is to explain what concept and its cognates mean, at least in a given context. That's what the challenge amounts to. Explain to us what you mean by a concept. What is a concept so that we may engineer it? You could pose the question. And this challenge willy-nilly reinforces the need for conceptual analysis. Right? So I think Hermann himself here shows why conceptual analysis is needed for conceptual engineering. Okay, now more generally, I argue that conceptual engineering, incidentally also metaphysics, but you know, that's presupposes conceptual analysis. So conceptual engineering must aim at improving the way we categorize things and the way we reason about things. And, you know, this change must somehow be different from, go beyond simply changing our beliefs and theories, as in scientific concept formation. So the conceptual engineers are committed to some distinction between the conceptual and the factual, I think. And they would be horrified by, you know, diverging from the Quine line here, but I think they are committed to it. So now, you know, so we want to improve the way we categorize and reason about phenomena, but... here's a quote from someone who expresses my descriptivist truism. Without some conceptual clarification, we will be in the dark concerning our subject matter. And this applies equally to the subject matter of concepts and their improvement. But nevertheless, Kaplan insists emphatically that conceptual clarification isn't needed, not even for propedeutic purposes. Now, you know, to his credit, he's alive to the fact that this is, you know, this position stands in need of vindication. So he's alive to the difficulty that confronts him in the form of the descriptivist truism. Doesn't the anti-descriptive argument assume that we first engage in important descriptive work, figuring out whether our concepts are defective and how they can be improved? Surely that is a descriptive task. Isn't it? My answer, yes. Not so Hermann's answer. His response is one of radical skepticism about all concepts. Oops, sorry. The argument that our concepts are defective has no limit. It applies equally to the terms that occur in the reply to the anti-descriptive arguments all the concepts involved in describing the critical constructive project of conceptual engineering should themselves be subject to constant critical assessment and skepticism. The very terminology in which we engage in the critical project is itself suspect. Of course, even this articulation of the self-reflective nature of the core revisionist argument should be subject to that very same kind of criticism. Yeah, I mean, you know, makes Descartes in the First Meditation look like a dogmatist. I think he's clearly sawing off the branch on which he's sitting. I'll just try to, and that is a very important epistemological point, incidentally, what I detect here is home field advantage for descriptivism. Now, Kaplan can only block the descriptivist truism by repudiating, bracketing all the concepts which are used either by the descriptivist or himself in his criticism. Now, he duly acknowledges that this hyperbolical doubt applies to his own concepts as well. But this commits him to bracketing or abandoning his own concepts. He can only be in good faith if he tells you, okay, I'm criticizing you as a descriptivist, but what I say is, of course, you know, very likely to be completely incoherent or whatnot, because my concepts are no good. Well, thanks a lot. So, you know, by contrast, descriptivists like me can in good faith continue to use their concepts. Yeah? We have home field advantage because the skeptic must provide compelling and non-self-defeating reasons for abandoning the concepts which we are using. Right? And he needs to provide, you know, a vindication of his own concepts that he uses in these justifications himself. So, bottom line, one cannot justify anything without relying on some concepts, right? And for a doubt to be taken seriously, it has to be justified. With apologies to Socrates, the unjustified doubt is not worth examining. So I think we should just, you know, set store by these eclectic arguments and say, yes, that's all very well. You think your concepts are rubbish. Perhaps you're right, but let's get on with it. Okay, so, you know, this is perhaps the easier part, but it is very epistemological, just to show that it's not completely beside the topic of the conference. So now conceptual analysis in metaphysics. So far, I have defended conceptual analysis against the pretensions of exclusionary conceptual engineering, against the pretensions of radically skeptical conceptual engineering in particular. Now, traditional metaphysics, you know, the one that is concerned with the kind of de re essences that Claudine also spoke about, it need not share the hyperbolical doubt which fuels exclusionary conceptual engineering, but, you know, I think it does share the conviction that real or foundational philosophy should not be concerned with trivial things such as words or even concepts. It should concern the world and the essences of things. You know, that's the metaphysical quest for essences. Now, you know, there are many considerations to this effect, and of course, you know, I can't present even a small selection from them or my reactions to them, but I, you know, want to just have a look at two considerations which, you know, are often advanced in this context. And, okay, and, you know, because I want to link up with the idea of essence, I will, you know, sort of use what is questions as a kind of theme here. Okay, now, you know, unlike Kaplan in his more sort of reckless moments, any sane conceptual analyst will recognize the difference between words and concepts on the one hand and the things they denote or apply to on the other. Now, he or she will not think that she's changing the world directly by fiddling with the intention of words. Okay, So nonetheless, I think one can make out a case for saying that the question, what is F, what is justice, what is knowledge, what is free choice, how does benefiting someone differ from being altruistic, etc., etc. Such what is questions and related questions often concern the meaning of words. Now, of course, questions of this form can be requests for information about F's, information about empirical information about F's. So, you know, take altruism. What is altruism? Do we need to distinguish biological altruism from psychological altruism, etc.? Now, you know, what is, for instance, biological altruism? You know, you may ask for empirical information about a phenomenon of which you already have a preconception. Biological altruism is simply altruism in which the altruist incurs a cost and benefits others, right? And then you may ask, how could such a thing have evolved? And then evolutionary theorists can provide you with explanations saying, you know, there can be reciprocal altruism. I scratch your back because you'll scratch my back. There can be kinship altruism for Darwinian reasons. And that's, you know, that tells you something about what biological altruism is. Yeah? But it's not the definition of biological altruism. It doesn't give you the preconception that you need in order to pose and answer these questions purposefully. So you know, you may ask, when you ask what is F or what is an F, you may ask for empirical information in the sense of you may be interested in what scientists call the nature of Fs, the cluster of properties that causally explain the behavior of things that are F. But these questions are concern matters of fact, and they are based on experience. Now, what is questions as posed in reflection, and this should read in philosophical reflection, are not directed at contingent features of F's. I mean, I don't have to tell you as modal metaphysicians. So they're not directed at contingent features of F's, regardless of how fundamental these features are. Because, you know, these contingent features are features that instances of the concept may or may not possess, and they need to be established by empirically scrutinizing these instances. But, you know, oh God, something's missing here. The features that metaphysicians ask concern essential features, right? They're not contingent, they're essential features. And these essential features, apologies for a missing paragraph here, these essential features, at least in the first instance, are features that can be pinpointed by explaining what the term F means, right? So if you you know, are concerned about the essential features of biological altruism, an essential feature of biological altruism is you've got one agent that incurs a cost to benefit another agent, and there's no presupposition that there is any conscious decision on the part of the altruist to behave in a way which puts the altruist at risk and benefits or harms the altruist and benefits someone else. So, and that's an explanation of the essence of biological altruism. Now, such an explanation is an explanation of what the term biological altruism means. It specifies what counts as being altruistic in the biological sense, what it is to be a biological altruist, and it does so independently of features that, you know, a specimen of biological altruism may or may not possess. You know, I mean, Darwin could be entirely wrong, and still that definition stands. That's what it is to be a biological altruist. So I think we can answer what is questions of this kind by explaining what the term F means. Same for questions which I'm inclined to call constitutive questions. Questions of the form, what makes something an F? These can be requests, on the one hand, for causal explanations that specify how come that certain objects arrive, how come that such a thing as a biological altruism exists. But there can also be requests that for a semantic explanation, as an explanation that specifies what constitutes being an F. The features by virtue of which something qualifies, e.g., as a case of biological altruism in the first place. I'll drop this comment on Carnap. Okay, so I do think there may be more types of what is questions, but you know these are two types of what is questions. I think they can be clearly held apart. I think we do hold them apart in our pre-philosophical practice. But you know, just to say that, of course, conceptual analysis speaks to natures in a certain understanding of nature. It doesn't speak to nature in another understanding of nature, which is, I think, the proper subject of science. Okay, what to do about concepts? Now, this is as dogmatic as it comes. I'll tell you simply my concept of a concept, or my analysis of the concept of a concept, is that concepts are rules or principles of intellectual operations, rules or principles of classification and inference. Okay, let's accept that, and then, you know, the question is, well, look, if that's your conception of concepts, and you owe us a conception of concepts, Hermann is quite right about this, you know, how does that square with the idea that there's this autonomous activity of conceptual analysis? Now, you know, certainly this is a relatively unmetaphysical explanation of what concepts are. Yeah. I think you can get you know, much heavier doses of metaphysics than this. But, you know, might say, okay, so, you know, for instance, for me, concepts are not bona fide abstract mental or neural entities. They are not, you know, the sort of components of structured propositions. They are not mental representations. They are not neural processes. Yeah? Those are things that, you know, Platonists or naturalists might, metaphysicians might say about concepts. So, you know, I don't want to reify concepts. Nevertheless, you know, there's a problem, but first, yeah. What this means is that the analysis of concepts is not a terribly metaphysical enterprise. It's not the decomposition of complex abstract entities or complex neural entities into parts. What it is the articulation or explication of the rules guiding certain intellectual and linguistic operations. And by the same token, concept formation, apologies for the typo, is the construction or modification of these rules. Now, protest aren't intellectual or linguistic operations, clearly part of mental or linguistic reality. My answer, well, in one sense, yes, the empirical investigation of conceptual thinking is the task for psychology, cognitive science and neuroscience, and mutatis mutandis, empirical investigations into what expressions in a given language mean, are a matter for empirical linguistics. But conceptual analysis deals with the meaning of expressions or the rules of intellectual operations from a particular perspective and for a distinct purpose. I think this is a point that is often missed about conceptual analysis. It's often presented as if conceptual analysis was a kind of l'art pour l'art. You know, people run around, what is virtue, what is justice? You know, what are the necessary conditions of a free decision, etc. That's not true. Conceptual analysis always takes place because you have problems with independent questions. I mean, Socrates, for instance, I mean, of course, he did want to annoy his fellow Athenians, but, you know, he was troubled by the question, what is virtue, because of an antecedent, very important question, namely the question, can virtue be taught? And he thought you need to know what virtue is in order to, you know, decide on that question. And I think the same goes for contemporary or modern conceptual analysis. So conceptual analysis is not concerned with accurately describing or causally explaining why members of a linguistic community employ certain expressions. It articulates rules, in philosophical discourse. It wants to know, how are you using the term knowledge when you tell me that true belief differs from knowledge? So it's the context dependence, the tying analysis to a philosophical or wider dialectic, because while Ryle and Wittgenstein were particularly interested in elucidating concepts in the process of tackling philosophical problems, you can extend this. And this extension has a name. It's called critical thinking. And as I say in my book about what is analytic philosophy should be critical thinking writ large. I think that is, its true legacy. So what is important now from an epistemological perspective is that the conceptual analyst does not adopt the external empirical perspective of a psychologist or linguist. Now, she may articulate her own understanding of a philosophically pertinent expression. Well, what I mean by distributive justice is this, and you may mean something different. Depending on what you mean and what I mean, there will be a difference between doing what is right and doing what is just. For instance, just to show some of the possible repercussions. Now, so a conceptual analyst might be simply articulating her own understanding of a philosophically contested word, or she may spell out the understanding which underlies the questions, statements, and arguments of her interlocutor. But, and this is where I come to my final point, perhaps a constructive point, even though conceptual analysis often starts within a dialectical context, ultimately the conceptual explanations will eventually rely on understanding of the relevant expressions operative in a linguistic community, and ultimately the linguistic community to which the interlocutors belong. It could be belonging to the Anglophone linguistic community, which is, second home, home from home for, I think, many of us. Now, why is that? Well, the primordial and most fundamental philosophical questions are couched in terms of shared natural languages. Shared natural languages are the medium of all explanation. And I think keeping that in mind is important because, ultimately we are talking about, if you wish, ordinary expressions, not just in the realm of ethics, but also in concerning questions concerning the mind. What is consciousness? Well, ultimately, it's not anything that Chalmers invented, right? Consciousness, someone is conscious of something, or someone is conscious or unconscious, and that's the starting point of our puzzles about consciousness. It also concerns semantic questions. Semantics is not simply a theoretical enterprise. It must start out from our everyday use of semantic notions. Okay, almost there. So now, normally this spelling out of the meaning of terms which are entrenched in or stem from ordinary natural languages, that is nowadays presented as an appeal to intuitions. Many friends of conceptual analysis, many friends of descriptive methods in philosophy think, well, okay, we have our data too, we simply appeal to intuitions. My intuition is that, whatever, take your favorite Getty case, and this is not or is, after all, a case of knowledge. Now, I think that we should reject this appeal to intuitions. This is something, one of the few points on which I entirely agree with Herman Kaplan and Timothy Williamson. Appeal to intuitions is no good. Okay, now what are intuitions? And, completely consistently, I start out with the everyday understanding of intuitions. In everyday parlance, an intuition is a hunch. It's my intuition that it won't rain. I'm not a meteorologist. I don't know conditions in Paris. You know, overcast, does that mean rain in October? No idea, but my hunch is it won't rain today. Now, that's normally called an intuition, but it has no special epistemic authority whatever. Yeah? It might have an epistemic authority if, as in the case of my father-in-law, his hunches about the weather, you know, 3 days hither, are always reliable. Right? Then it has credentials, but not as an intuition, but because it's an intuition that has proven to be reliable. Something about his hunches has proven to be reliable. That's my justification for relying on him when planning a mountaineering tour. Okay, so that's one thing an intuition is, and that's in everyday parlance. Another thing that intuitions is, well, I think it's an explication of the concept that a particular intuitor employs. And that is not a bona fide intuition, but rather, by any other name, an explanation of what the intuitor means by the concept concerned. So it's my intuition that they do have water on twin Earths. Never mind Kripke, but that's my intuition, someone would say. But I would say, well, the way I use the term water, that's not a case of, that is a case of water. So if someone tells you it is my intuition that such and such is or is not a case of F, a case of justice, or something falling under natural kind term, in a philosophical debate, this amounts to saying, well, one of two things, either I as individual speaker would not call that an F, I would not count that as an F, and it therefore amounts to explicating his understanding of the term, explicating what, very loosely speaking, I will call speaker's meaning, or it is a case of explicating what we, qua competent speakers, would count as F. So it is an articulation of the conventional meaning of the expression. And I think ultimately, the speaker's meaning presupposes conventional meaning. You can't speak or mean anything without conventional meaning. And therefore, I will now end with a word about, what sort of thing do we explicate or articulate when we articulate the conventional meanings we take to be operative, for instance, in a philosophical debate. Okay, now, one thing for a start, the knowledge provided by such explication is not a priori in the sense of the rationalists. It is a priori at most in a Kantian sense. Now, it presupposes learning for its genesis, but it is, just as in Kant, not empirical because its epistemic warrant is different. Its epistemic warrant is one's own linguistic competence. Yeah. Why wouldn't you call that a case of, knowledge? Well, because that's how I understand knowledge. Knowledge must not simply be a matter of luck. So I articulate my linguistic competence. That means I articulate an understanding which I have acquired, if I have acquired it, as part of immersion into a shared linguistic practice. And this is where, unfortunately, way too briefly, Hare and Hanfling have invoked the idea of a participatory knowledge. Yeah, as members of a linguistic community, we have participatory knowledge, and this kind of participatory knowledge they diagnose in social practices such as a game or a dance. Now there are countless differences between dances and games and language, right? I'll only mention one of them, but nevertheless, there is this underlying core. Yeah? There is a practice we engage in. The practice is, in some loose sense, rule-guided. We have an understanding of these rules, even if we cannot express them precisely or, in a way that captures all of the subtleties, which we do adhere to in practice. And so I do think that what we do in conceptual analysis, we explicate logical semantic rules, and these rules, and I'm 100% Wittgensteinian on this, these rules are flexible, they are context dependent, they are by and large vague, yeah, but there are these rules which we can formulate at least when prompted and with a bit of assistance, and we explicate rules about, for instance, the use of the term being kind, being altruistic, which are part of the rules governing a practice in which we participate willy-nilly. And that's, I think, an important difference, of course, to dances and games. Thank God I can't refuse to participate in a dance. I can't refuse to participate in some natural language, and in fact, I try to participate in quite a few. More or less successfully, and therefore, this may not have been a successful participation, but I thank you for your patience and look forward to your questions.